In the morning, it's my job to go to the grocer opposite the church. I walk into the shop. Merhaba, Osild. My chime is as loud as the bell that hangs over the door. Call me uncle, he shoots back, with a cackle. How many times do I have to tell you? Why stand on formalities when I see you every day? Osild and me were not related. He's a Greek-speaking Turk from Mytilini, an island on the Greek side of the border. The Greek government ousted Osil and many Turks like him in 55. Being an islander, portly Osil wanted to stay close to the sea. That's why he settled on Tenedos. He took charge of the grocer's shop when the Greek owner migrated to America. One day this'll be over, Osil remarks, making a sweeping gesture. I'm not sure if he means the troubles that surround us or the world in general. Then I can go back to my grandfather's olive groves. May he forgive me for abandoning them. Osil greets me in Greek, and I answer in Turkish. It's a game we play. When my pockets are empty and I can't pay for the goods I buy with a kuruş or a lira, Osil takes a pencil from behind his ear, wets it on his tongue and writes the amount in a spiral notebook. Pay next month, he says. Shrugging, it's nothing to him. It's not like we're going anywhere. Or better still, tell that good-hearted father of yours to remember me when he has half a dozen red mullet to spare, or an octopus. Now that would be nice grilled with a squeeze of lemon. At home in the kitchen, I gulp a bowl of yesterday's bread soaked in scalding salty milk, sprinkled with thyme. I button my coat and dash out. The Bugday is due back soon. I'll greet my father and cousin Zotiko and then go to school. Don't dawdle. Head straight for the harbour, my mother warns. The empty streets echo with my footsteps. It's been raining through the night and a southwesterly trimmed with barbed wire brings tears to my eyes. The Bugday will be having a hard time of it in the waves. Pulling the multicoloured beanie over my ears, I set off at a canter, glad for the mittens and scarf my mother knitted. By the time I emerge from under the avenue of linden and plane trees on the waterfront, the sun is brushing the horizon with the downy feathers of newborn chicks. There is no sign of the Bugday. The force of the wind almost picks me up and tosses me aside like scrap paper. Apart from two men tarring a docked boat, there's no one about. Boats and kayaks lurch crazily in the water, their bells chiming with alarm. Finally, the Bugday appears on the crest of a wave. It resembles a piece of driftwood heaving and tossing on the back of a giant serpent. I dash to the end of the pier and wait excitedly until it draws near enough for me to recognize the faces of the men on board. There's Captain Stereños, his son-in-law Anistas, the new occasional hand Usin, and good old Izet. It's good to see him again. It's been too long. At starboard, Athena's brother Zotiko stands steady as a mast beside my father. I wave, jumping up and down as much with excitement as to keep warm. Zotiko tosses two thick ropes overboard. Tie them round the bollards, he yells, above the roar of the storm. I do as he says. Then he extends his arms. Come on, he calls out, wiggling his fingers. Come aboard. I toss back my head. No. There's half a world between the pier and the boat. Water's frothing down there as if it's boiling in a cauldron. Heidi, don't be scared. I'm right here. I'll catch you, he calls again. Don't you trust me? The other men gather to watch. This is a test. If I jump, it will prove that I am a man. On the other hand, if I jump and miss the boat, I'll fall in the drink and drown. Heidi, Zotiko, leave the boy alone, Izet says. Can't you see his legs aren't long enough? He shakes his head, disgusted. Come on, coward! Zotiko calls out again. Don't make me wait. My father's gone below deck, so he doesn't have to watch his only son drown. Tossed on the waves, the Bugday goes up and down. 1 minute it's high above, the next way below the frothing moor. If I'm to come out of this alive, I will have to time it to the second. I leap into the void. For what seems an eternity, I freeze in mid-air. Nothing exists but me with my arms and legs extended. Even the water stops churning. My right hand is out, ready to grab life. When movement returns, I fly through the air. My hand closes around something. The tip of my boot makes contact with what I hope is wood. And, as I'm about to give up hope, I fall into Zotico's arms. The men clap. Heidi almost pissed himself, Usin says. Everybody laughs. I grin into the smelly weave of Zotico's black jumper. My heart is hammering, and my knees are wobbly. My father emerges to clap me on the back. Bravo, he says. You did good. Azet clasps my hand in his paw. We shake hands. Don't ever do that again, he mutters, bending down. Your mother would eat us alive if anything happened to you. He too smells of fish and brine. Scales are embedded in the warp and weft of his jumper. They glint on his high rubber boots. The caique bucks and tosses in the storm. Fat raindrops splatter the deck. Then almost instantly, the rain stops and wind rams into the boat. It pitches to one side. Everything and everyone is thrown about. I fall down. Quick as lightning, Zotico dashes over. I think it's to make sure I'm unharmed. Instead, he slips a piece of paper into my fist. Take this to her as soon as you get off the boat, he mutters, and dashes off again. I don't even bother looking at the note. I know what it is. A note for his girlfriend, Efigenia. I slip it into my pocket. The other men work hard to secure things and lash them down. When the alarm is over, Azet and Usin unload crates filled with fish, octopus, sea urchins, and a lobster. There is even a small shark hacked into two. They set the crates on the pier and wait for the housewives to come and buy the fresh fish. The greater portion of the catch has been sold to wholesalers on the mainland. Zotico comes down the gangplank and lopes by with a plastic bag slimy with fish. He's in a hurry, says Azet, eyeing him off. He's got fire in his loins, my father adds. Let's hope he comes to his senses before it's too late. They chuckle and sink into themselves. Don't be like that, Azet admonishes after a while. What else is there for a man to do? He works and he loves. There are no greater gifts. My father tries to peg him. You can say that, after what you've been through. Experience compels me to speak, Azet says. There must be room for forgiveness. Otherwise, what's the purpose of life? My father takes a drag on his cigarette. You're a dervish, my friend, he observes, breathing out smoke that is instantly shredded by a gust. Not a fisherman. Azet is my father's drinking partner. When they're on dry land, they sit in the tavern, knocking back bottles of wine. They drink and stare into space, each man present in body, yet elsewhere in his thoughts. Azet studies the world through eyes filled with sadness and yearning. A devout Muslim, but not too exemplary because he's fond of a drop of lion's milk. He puts a lid on his thoughts by wearing a skullcap as white as his hair. One day, Azet said to me, I'm going to Mecca for the ultimate pilgrimage. Though, of course, I'll remain your protector for the rest of my days, and happily so. Before he cast his lot in with us, Azet lived in the coastal town of Tekirdağ. He was married then. My wife's eyes were as beautiful as two suns at the zenith. Her face would have compelled sultans to abandon their thrones and palaces for her. She made those so-called movie stars look like the harlots that they are. Life was paradise. The only thing lacking was a child, that indispensable product of their loins that would proclaim their love to the world. Then his virtuous wife shacked up with an itinerant truck driver from Bursa, and overnight Azet's world turned into a melodrama. One day, so the story goes, he came home to an empty house. The adulteress had packed up and fled. To escape the neighbor's scorn, Azet packed his bags and settled on Bozjada. "Here I hope to leave behind the miseries of the world," he told my father when they first met, "and the shabby way people treat one another." Azet and I clicked straight away. We first met on a trip to Çanakkale. When the other fishermen trooped off to the tavern in the evening, Azet stayed behind. My father tried to talk him into going with them. "He'll be all right on his own," Baba said. Azet wouldn't hear of it. "I can drink any night of the week," he replied. "But how often do I get to be a father?" As another day fizzled on the water, the Turkish man from Tekirdağ and the Greek boy from Tenedos walked hand in hand to an open-air cinema. They were going to watch a film under the stars. The boy sat on a wooden chair beside the man. The night was balmy and clouds of cigarette smoke intermittently obscured the screen. The patrons wore shirt sleeves and mosquitoes buzzed in the humid air. As the movie began, people fanned themselves with folded newspapers and crunched peanuts and roasted sunflower seeds. In the half-light, the man from Tekirdağ kept turning his head. He'd beam at the boy as if Allah had given him a precious gift. "Would you like another bottle of gazoza, Yavrum?" he whispered, placing his mouth close to the boy's ear. "How about more sunflower seeds? You must be cold. Here, drape my jacket over your shoulders." When the film ended, the boy from Tenedos was asleep. The man from Tekirdağ lifted his charge and carried him back to the kayık. "I have been thinking about the visit to my brother's grave. Baba," I say, tugging his sleeve, "why is my brother's grave unmarked?" He looks at me as if we're both about to topple off a clifftop. His eyelids flutter uncertainly. "What?" he says, frowning. "He ought to have a name on his cross, like everyone else. That way the world won't ever forget who he is." My father turns away. When he faces me again, his eyes are marbles. For a second, I think he's going to give me a backhander, but he's never hit me, so I relax. "Who's been putting this rubbish into your head?" he asks, crouching on his haunches. He takes hold of my shoulders and speaks directly into my face. I smell tobacco on his breath. "There's no brother," he says, emphatic. "You are the first, and Electra the second. There is no other child. God hasn't blessed us with more children. I wish that he would." He speaks slowly, deliberately, the way people speak to Aristo's imbecile brother. "What's got into you? Why are you saying these things?" He is upset, and I'm sorry I didn't think carefully before opening my big mouth again. He throws down his cigarette. "There is so another child," I persist. "My mother took me to his grave. He has the same name as me and he's buried under the almond tree." Another squall drives the rain parallel to the ground. "Listen," my father says. "I'm going to say this once and I'm not going to repeat it again. There is no child. I don't want to hear you say such things. What if someone hears? We'll be a laughingstock. You must have dreamt it," he adds, wiping his hands and rising on two long legs. "Take these fish to your mother," my father orders, "and tell her I'll be home later.